Welcome to today's program titled International Non-Compete Law Update. At this time, all participants are in listen-only mode. For those of you who are logged into the web presentation, you are encouraged to submit questions throughout the conference by selecting the chat pod located in the lower left corner of your screen, then type and send your question that way. For those interested in obtaining CLE credit for this webinar, an attendance verification code will be read during the presentation that will be required on all CLE attendance affirmation forms. Please write this code down. It will not be reread, and it is required for CLE credit. Copies of the webinar recording and PowerPoint presentation will be distributed to attendees in the days following the webinar. At this time, I'd like to turn the program over to Dominique Hodson. You may begin.
Thank you very much. Good morning, folks. My name is Dominique Hodson. I am a partner in Seyfarth Shaw's International Employment Law Group. My practice involves assisting employers with, broadly speaking, operations anywhere in the world with their employment law issues. Anywhere in the world, not including the United States. I have many, many very capable partners at Seyfarth who can help you and help our clients with that. I've been doing this since about 2001, so I've seen a few things happen, and I can say that it's never a dull moment in international employment law. What I'm hoping to do today, folks, is just talk a little bit about some of the ideas and some of the themes that we see with non-competes and to a lesser extent, non-solicits in the international context. If we just move it along, let's get along to sort of set the baseline for what we're talking about with some of the terminology. So when I'm talking about a non-compete, and let's keep in mind that I'm talking about today generally activities that happen after employment. One of the funny things is that there actually can be rules about restricting employees' activities during employment. I think we're probably all quite used to the idea that we can basically restrict employees from doing whatever they like when they're working for us. There are quite a number of countries outside of the United States who will actually not allow an employer to dictate to the employee what they can do outside of working time. And in fact, in some countries, it is even possible for an employer to have an involvement in a competing organization, provided they don't otherwise breach their duties of good faith and fidelity. Today, I won't be talking about that. I'm going to be talking about the post-termination issues. When I talk about a non-compete, generally speaking, it may not always be a non-competition, but what it is going to be talking about is restricting an employee from working in a particular field of work after their employment with the employer terminates. I think we all like to call it a non-compete because it's quite convenient. It's not always the case that such clauses prevent competition. So that's the first point. I think the next point is, as I flagged here, when we're talking about non-solicits, customer non-solicits, and it can go broader than a customer non-solicit. There can be a client. There's not a great deal of difference, obviously. We can talk about suppliers. We can talk about partners. People that we, as our company, do business with. That is basically what we're talking about when we're talking about a customer non-solicit. And what you're trying to say is that we are dealing with situations where we're saying to the former employee, you may not try and solicit business from this individual, or you may not even accept business from this particular individual company or business. Employee non-solicits, that's fairly straightforward. It prevents the former employee from trying to solicit or hiring your own employees or consultants or directors, officers, however broadly you'd like to define that. And the final post-termination restrictive covenant, which often gets overlooked but is still often subject to the rules on post-termination restrictive covenants, particularly in common law jurisdictions, is the confidentiality obligation. We obviously look at a confidentiality obligation as being a key obligation that employees have in terms of protecting confidential information that they gained while they were employed by us. When they leave us, we don't want the employees to use that information. So the most common restrictive covenant post-termination that you will see is the confidentiality obligation. perhaps ironically, it can also be the most difficult to enforce, particularly when we're looking at countries outside of the common law. And we'll talk a little bit about that a bit later, but the reason for that is that we're looking at countries whose judicial system do not have large-scale discovery. So trying to prove a breach of confidentiality can often be a massive undertaking because it will be your responsibility as the employer to actually prove that the breach has occurred, and you don't get to do so, but you don't get to bolster your arguments by engaging in a great deal of discovery. So you'll often see, if you really do want to protect confidential information, and it's a little counterintuitive, but if you really do want to protect your confidential information, a non-compete can be the best way to do it. But as I hope you will see later today, it doesn't come without some downside. Just adopting a blanket non-compete in the same way that we tend to adopt a blanket confidentiality obligation, if you do that internationally, you're going to run into a lot of problems. And it's not only that you have unenforceable clauses, but you might end up costing yourself a lot of money. So we're going to move on. As I said, we're going to talk about themes. I can't, and I think probably everyone on this call appreciates this, I can't sit here today and tell you that this is the law of international non-competes. There is no law of international non-competes. You've got many countries, you've got many rules. Some of those rules are based on case law in the particular country. There's plenty of countries which have very prescriptive statutory rules and modifications. You've even got a couple of countries, and France is always top of this list, where you can find non-compete and non-solicit obligations actually contained in binding collective agreements that are binding on your business, whether or not you have any interaction with the union. The next thing that you want to keep in mind when you're considering, how do I use my non-compete, non-solicit, there's no uniformity within regions. So these days, it's pretty typical to see that our businesses are aligned along a regional basis. That does not mean that when the business who's responsible for that region comes and says, okay, we need non-competes for everyone in the region, that you'll be facing similar rules, similar regulations within that region. Nothing could be further from the truth. And even in Europe, where we're all very aware of how there has been a drive to try and standardize a lot of the rules and through directives and so on, you don't have uniform rules within Europe. And you can go from the UK across the channel to France and then across the border to Germany, and you have three completely different regimes regulating non-competes. So I'll mention a few different countries here and there as examples, but we're not going to go into a deep dive on any particular country today. I'd, of course, be delighted to have a chat about any particular country after the webinar today if you'd like to get in contact. But the sheer depth and variety of the rules sort of prevents us from doing any real deep dive into any particular country. That said, I will be doing a bit of an examination of the rules that apply in a common law country, because they do all have a common source, which tends to be the UK or the English case law. And you'll even see that, of course, in the United States, where you can a lot of these rules that apply in the common law countries are going to be quite familiar to you. When you go out and you start thinking about, okay, well, are we going to be using non-competes, non-solicits? Do we need to introduce it? As you probably picked up now, you cannot have a one-size-fits-all. So you do need to tailor it by country, and you're going to need to tailor it by employee, as I hope will be evident once we get to the end of this webinar. If there is one rule that I would say to you, is that it's not always the case, but it's a pretty good case. If you don't have an agreement, then you typically don't have any real restrictions. I have seen many, many businesses come to their advisors, come to HR, come to the legal and say, I know that this former employee is calling up our employees and trying to get them to go work for them. We have to stop this now. The first question that comes back is, okay, can I see their offer letter? We've lost it. Okay, can I see their confidentiality agreement? Well, we don't have those. And at that point, the conversation comes to a bit of a crashing halt, I'm afraid. Generally speaking, if somebody wants to go out and compete against you, if somebody wants to go out after leaving you and solicit your employees, and you have not made a specific agreement with them that they can't do that, then they are free to do that. So always do think about that. Think about how valuable your IP is. Think about how valuable your employees are to you at any particular stage. Have you invested a lot of training in them? A lot of those decisions are going to drive do we need to have non-competes? Do we need to have non-solicits? Okay, so I mentioned on the slide before, we're going to talk a little bit about the common law jurisdictions because I think in some ways it can be useful because it's probably the closest that we can get to a one-size-fits-all approach, at least for some countries. And some of these countries, as American multinationals, tend to be countries where we do have sizable operations. So obviously, your original common law jurisdiction, the OG, is the United Kingdom. But then you also look at Canada, my home country, Australia, and then you know, its neighbour, New Zealand. You go to Asia, you've got Singapore, Hong Kong, India, you've got Malaysia, you have a bunch of African countries, you've got some Caribbean countries. So you do find that the English legal system has influenced quite a lot of the rules around the world, and in a significant part of the parts of the world where major business operations tend to be established. And as I say, we're talking about Canada, we're talking about Singapore, Hong Kong, India, though India has its own rule, which I'll come to at the end. So what's the rule then when you're talking about a common law country? What's the basic starting point? Basic starting point is a post-termination restrictive covenant is void unless it's reasonable to protect the legitimate interest of the employer. There's a couple more bells and whistles to that. There's a public policy aspect to it that needs to be considered. But if you're looking at a basic rule, if I have to talk about get in an elevator and talk about non-competes in the UK or Singapore, that's what I'd say. Now, what is a legitimate interest? Just wanting to stop an employee competing against you after their employment terminates is not a legitimate interest. Now, for a lot of that's probably not an unusual thing to hear. It can often be a tough thing for the business to hear that, well, we need to actually be protecting something more than just the fact that you want this person to stop competing with us. But you know, that is a fundamental aspect of all common law jurisdictions that they are going to start looking at. So the main point, as you can see, is reasonableness. What do the courts tend to look at and what should we be looking at when we're drafting our clauses for reasonableness? Well, we look at the activities that are prescribed. What can the employee do? What can't the employee do? We look for the period of time which the prescribed activities are in effect. So for how long after termination are they not allowed to compete with you? How long after termination can they not solicit your employees? And the geographic area in which the prescription applies. Does it apply in the United Kingdom? Does it apply all throughout Europe? Does it apply in British Columbia if you're up in Canada? Does it apply throughout Canada? If you're in Hong Kong, does it apply in Hong Kong? Does it apply in Hong Kong, Taiwan, and China? Does it apply throughout Asia? And what does Asia mean? Which sort of floats into my next point is that these clauses, typically speaking, are going to be construed rather strictly. It is not the situation where we can sort of just bumble into it and think, oh, well, I'll get it close enough. And you know, as long as people can roughly tell what I mean, it'll all be good. Most of the time it won't. If there is uncertainty in the clause, that is a good enough reason quite often for a court to strike it down because the court will say the employee is unable to know what he or she may do after the termination of their employment. And given the public interest in having the employee work, that is unreasonable. So you need precision in your drafting. And some of you may have seen this before if you've already done this as a project. You might see situations where the European lawyers probably don't fiddle around with the clauses too much. They put in a whole lot of stuff about compensation and waivers and so on like that. But in terms of the bones of the clauses, you know, they don't touch too much. Send it to the English lawyers, the Australian lawyers, the Singaporean lawyers, the Canadian lawyers, and you suddenly find your clauses coming back completely redlined. And we'll talk about why when we look at an example clause a bit later, but it is because you need real precision, because if the clause isn't enforceable, then it isn't enforceable, and it will get struck. Reasonable to protect the legitimate interest. What are some of the legitimate interests that you see in the common law jurisdictions that are going to be recognised? Well, the first is obviously the protection of confidential information. If you're in a situation where the employee has got a whole lot of your confidential information in their head, and if they go and work for an employer, you know, it's reasonable to expect that they're going to use that confidential information, then a non-compete couldn't be seen as reasonable in that light. It is preventing the disclosure of your confidential information to a competitor, which the courts will generally see as being a interest which sort of rules over the interest of the public in having free competition. Interesting point here. I'm often asked, well, can't we just go with some kind of argument about inevitable disclosure? That doctrine doesn't really exist outside of the United States, but it still comes in when we're talking about the protection of confidential information. It comes in via a side door because it is a way to bolster your non-compete. You say, this person has confidential information. If they go work for a competitor, they can't avoid disclosing this confidential information. Therefore, my non-compete is valid. Now, in the absence of your non-compete, you may be a bit lost, even if they do, even if there is inevitable disclosure. But if you do have your non-compete, if you can say that there is going to be inevitable disclosure of my confidential information if they work in this job, that's a good way to show that your non-compete is valid. The other is obviously protection of your investment in a customer, a client, an employee connection, or the amount of training that you put into an employee. You'll commonly see that. It takes time to build up goodwill with your customers. It takes time to make sure that you've got the right suppliers, giving you the products that you need in a way that meets your QA needs. The courts will recognize that there is a legitimate interest in protecting those, that you have expended time, that you have expended effort in developing those contacts. And in those circumstances, it is unfair for an employee to leave employment and then take advantage of those connections. And so when you're looking about a non-solicitation obligation, that is what you're wanting to try and demonstrate. You're wanting to try and demonstrate that the employee is able to take unfair advantage of a particular connection with a customer, with a supplier, with an employee, with a contractor, to your detriment in a way that your average person on the street would not be able to do. That's very helpful in demonstrating that you've got a legitimate interest in protecting solicitation against certain points. I'm just moving along again. Well, we're talking about activities prescribed here. So the first point that I talked about, what are some of the traps that we can fall into when we're preparing a clause in a common law jurisdiction? Well, the first one, and we'll talk about this, about at what point do we measure reasonableness, but when we start applying it to an employee who's incapable of harming any of our legitimate interests. So if we're talking about one of our administrative staff, do we really have any legitimate interest in having an administrative staff going over to a competitor? Is there anything that an administrative staff could do that would actually harm our business? And this can actually extend quite high up in a business, because if you think about, well, what are the courts trying to protect? The courts are trying to protect goodwill. They're trying to protect confidential information. They're trying to protect strategic information. You can have people who are quite high up in the business who don't really have a great insight to those pieces of information, or they don't have a great deal of connection with your customers, with your suppliers. In those situations, no matter their seniority, no matter their relative importance within the organization, it can still be difficult to justify having a non-compete. Now, for example, can you justify having a non-compete for a lawyer? I can imagine in some circumstances you might, but I can imagine there's plenty of other circumstances when you might not. And we're even talking about senior lawyers here, or HR. How important is the information that HR has in their head about compensation, restructuring, about the business structure? How much do they actually have in their head, and how much detriment could that cause the employer if that were to be used for the benefit of a competitor? Those are some of the questions. Obviously, there's plenty of people who are capable of employing harming illegitimate interests, people who are involved in R&D, people in sales. I mean, the salesperson is actually one of the most classic type of people who you will be able to fairly easily demonstrate a legitimate interest in preventing them going to a competitor. So that sort of rolled into the next point, which is, well, okay, so what am I preventing the employee from doing? If you're preventing them from doing work for there's no risk of harm to a legitimate interest, well, then that's a problem as well, because your clause is overreaching. It's going too far. So, for example, if you're preventing competition with the company, and the company's in multiple businesses, or has, and the employee's only worked in one, are you then preventing the employee going off and working in a competing business line about which she or he has no knowledge? Because if you are, do you really have a legitimate interest in doing that? How does that employee harm you? The other thing is when you're talking about perhaps a organization, a competitor, if you're talking about a named competitor, which has multiple business lines. Okay, so you can't go organize, you can't go work for Company A. Company A is my biggest competitor. Problem is, Company A has a whole lot of other business, and you stopped the employee working in those other businesses in circumstances where there's no real prospect of them ever being able to harm you. Preventing employees from soliciting all employees and customers and so on. Well, which employees, customers, can you legitimately protect? Is it all customers? Is it the customers that the employees dealt with? Is it the customers that the employee has knowledge of? Even if they deal with them, do they actually know anything about the customer that would enable them to really influence and take away their business from you? Do they know anything about the employee that works for you? You know, what is the unfair advantage that they have vis-a-vis the average person on the street? Those are some of the questions which need to be asked. So, for example, here's some very loose clauses that I've talked that you can see about. So, employee must not be involved with any business entity division that competes with the company. And then here we talk about, and this is an important point, the company equaling, you'll often see this as a US drafting technique, company equaling the employer, the parents, the subsidiaries, affiliates, etc. As a general rule, I dislike seeing that kind of definition in a international confidentiality agreement or non-compete agreement or even employment agreement. You want it to be very clear who the legal entity which employs the employee is. And you want to be very clear about the associated legal entities that you are considering to be part of your group. So if you're looking at this as an employee and it says, okay, well, I can't work for any affiliate, what actually is an affiliate? I'm not really sure. Is it a JV? Is it a business partner? I don't know. And so that in itself, that vagueness can be enough to strike down that clause. And look, I'll come back and talk a little bit about all these clauses a bit more. But here's your classic non-solicit. Employee must not solicit, attempt to solicit, hire, be involved in the hiring, etc., any employee, contractor, consultant, so on of the company. An employee must not solicit, attempt to solicit any actual prospective customer, client, supplier, partner of the company, and so on. So when we talk about this, is the employee able to harm the company? Well, I've talked about that. No link to the relevant work of the employee. So what am I talking about? What business did the employee work in? When did she or he work in it? And what businesses, as I mentioned, do prescribe, when prescribing listed competitors, what businesses do they have? Am I stopping the employee from going to work for a business which has no, which does not compete with me at all? So if I just go back to the prior clause, so employee must not be involved with any business entity division that competes with the company. Okay, so that's pretty broad. And here we have the company. That's pretty broad here. So if the employee is involved in the manufacturing of widgets and we're now stopping them from going to be involved in a business which manufactures sprockets, is that legitimate? Often it's not. So how do we do that? What do we do? Employee must not be involved with any business entity division. Here's an example of something that we can do. Similar to, or that is the same, as a business in which the employee worked in the 12 months prior to termination. Because what does that do? Well, that means that we're now focusing in on knowledge that the employee has. And we're looking at the 12 months prior to termination. And we're saying, well, that's the key period because that's where the employee actually has knowledge that is relevant. And we're only confining it to the business that he or she worked in. Going back, when did she work in it? As I said, in 12 months. Do you have any interest, any legitimate interest in stopping your employee from competing in a business in which he or she worked in 10 years ago, but which he or she has no knowledge of anymore? That's why you go to that 12 months, and you'll typically see any well-drafted common law restraint is going to have a reference to the business in which the employee worked during the last 6 or the last 12 months of employment. And then prescribing listed competitors, people can often think that's better because, okay, well, I'm being very clear about saying who the competitors are. But as I've said, The downside of that is that those business competitors can have multiple businesses. And so not only do you need to list the competitors, but you still need to make sure that you're tying it back to the business that the employee worked in as being the business that you're concerned about. So it's not that they can't go work for a competitor, it's that they can't go work for a competitor in any business that is the same as a business that they participated in the 12 months prior to termination. When we're talking about employees and customers and so on, did the employee deal with, supervise, or have knowledge to the relevant employee? So fairly clear here. So must not solicit, attempt to solicit any employee, contractor, consultant, director of the company. So when you've got an employee in the States, or we're talking internationally here, an employee in the UK, and we're preventing them from soliciting an employee in Botswana that they've never dealt with. Has the clause gone too far? Yes, it has. So how do we deal with this? So must not solicit, attempt to solicit, hire any employee, and it's often any employee whom the employee has supervised, either directly or indirectly, or had material personal contact with, again, in the prior 12 months of employment. Because then we're focusing on, well, what is it that the employee is able to take advantage of? The employee is either able to take the knowledge gained through supervision, or the employee is able to take advantage of the personal connection that they have built with the employee in the 12 months prior to employment. But here's a further point. Is it an employee who can actually harm the company? You can't. In a lot of the common law courts will look at this and say, well, it's not just enough to say that it's an employee that the person supervised or the employee had knowledge, personal dealings with. It needs to be an important employee to the company. So again, you know, not to pick on administrators, but if we're talking about that, you know, you can't solicit an administrator, the court might say, well, you know, to be fair, it takes you about a week to train another administrator. I don't really see the harm in having somebody going and soliciting your administrative employees. Might be a bit of a hassle. You may not like it, but are you really protecting a legitimate interest? On the other hand, if you're stopping the employee from soliciting managerial employees, people who set the strategy for the business, people who go out and sell the business, people who develop the research and technology of the business, if we're preventing those kind of employees from being solicited, we've got a much, much better chance of our non-solicitation clause being enforced. Same with customers and clients. Okay, so we need to make sure that it's a customer, client, supplier, etc., about whom the employee has material knowledge or with whom the employee has dealt with in the prior 12 months of employment. Because it can't just be somebody, again, somebody, another customer scattered all over the world who the employee doesn't know. We need to tie it back to the actual knowledge of the employee, and we need to do this in the drafting. They're not just going to look at it and say, yeah, it's okay because the actual person that they solicited was someone they had this material interest. It's not enough to say, well, in reality, it would have been okay. Your clause has to make sure it only doesn't go too far. Moving back, and then the final point, again, that I wanted to talk about is, well, can the employee use confidential information to the employer's detriment? So you'll even see in some of the tighter clauses, you can't go work for a competitor in any business which is the same as the business in which you participated in the 12 months prior to the termination of employment, and then there'll be a further rider on it, in circumstances where you can use confidential information of the company to the company's detriment. So even if it is a similar business, if you can't use confidential information or you're not protecting the trade or goodwill of the former employer, even that might make it unenforceable. So what I'm trying to convey here, I guess, is that you really, when you see these long non-compete, non-solicit clauses that are used in the UK and used in Singapore, Hong Kong, South Africa, Canada, there's a reason for it. It's because you need to be really precise about it, and it needs to be precise at the beginning. The court isn't going to help you out. Talk about the period prescribed, some of the traps here. So the period of effect must be no longer than necessary, basically, and the court is not going to substitute its own time period for you. Again, you need to make sure that you're not overreaching. In most cases, in a common law country, you're going to find it very difficult to justify a non-compete that extends beyond 12 months of employment. And it's often going to be difficult to justify a non-compete that goes beyond 6 months post-termination of employment. So it's important to really decide and really, if you are going to use a non-compete, how long do we really need this to take effect for? How long is enough for the information to go stale? Because if you overreach, if you put too long in there, the whole clause falls over. And it's a terrible thing to fall over on because, generally speaking, you only need it for about 3 or 6 months for it to be effective. The other trap that you can fall into is that a lot of you have probably come across this idea of garden leave, which is an employee who's serving a period of notice. You don't have at-will employment outside of the US. People have to give notice and be given notice. So when they're serving a period of notice, you can say to them, hey, go home. We don't need you to do anything. Don't come to work. Don't log on. It's called garden leave. They are, at that point, off the market. So at that point, they're starting to go stale in terms of the information they know. If your clause does not take account of any period pre-termination during which they're on garden leave, then that can cause the clause to fall over as well. Because if, for example, you've got a 3-month notice period and a 12-month non-compete, and you enforce a 3 month of garden leave, effectively, you've kept the employee out for 15 months. And that's when a court might look at them and say, well, you didn't need 15 months. You only needed 12. You would have been fine if you took account of the garden leave, but you didn't. The whole clause is void. The whole clause is unenforceable. Final point, the geographical effect. Does it prevent competition in regions the company does not operate? So if you've got a business that operates only in South America, do you have any legitimate interest in preventing the employee from working in Europe? Does it prevent competition in regions the employee did not operate? So again, if you operate globally and the employee had responsibility for, let's say, South America, knew the South American business back to front, didn't have a clue about the EMEA, and you've gone and restricted an employee from working throughout the world, what is your justification for doing that? The employee doesn't have knowledge. How can the employee harm you in those other countries? So again, it's the other point that you need to make sure. You do not reach too far on geography. And that probably begs a question, well, can you actually have a global non-compete? Are there circumstances where it would be reasonable to say, well, the employee just can't work anywhere in the world? And I think the answer to that is going to be yes, because the way the world is changing. There was a case in Singapore last year where the non-compete, and it was in the broker-dealer field, non-compete operated on a global basis. And the court found, well, we're prepared to accept that because we recognize that today, in this type of business, it doesn't really matter where you work. It's the knowledge that you have and the way that you can log on and deal with customers over the computer, over the phone, and so on. So your actual place that you're working in isn't that important. So in those circumstances, yeah, a global non-compete was fine. So, and if you have the right type of employee, then yeah, enforcing a global non-compete, I think, will be possible. So then we're just moving along, and we're coming up to about the halfway point. So I want to read out here the CLE code, which I know many of you are eagerly waiting for. The CLE code is S for Sierra, the number 5, the number 3, the number 6, and the number 4. I'll say that again, S for Sierra, 5, 3, 6, 4. Couple of other issues when we talk about the common law jurisdictions. When do you assess reasonableness? Is it at the end of employment? Is it midway through the employment? No, it's generally speaking when you sign the non-compete clause. So you don't get, if the employee is being promoted during the time of their employment and what was an unreasonable non-compete clause at the beginning of employment has now become a reasonable one, you actually don't get the benefit of that. So again, my point for the common law jurisdictions, make sure you get it right at the start when you're entering into these agreements. Is consideration necessary for the restrictive covenant? That's often not a easy question to ask. Answer, a lot of common law jurisdictions allow you to have agreements without any consideration if you execute them as a deed. But you know, I would say that generally speaking, a court is going to be a lot more comfortable if there was consideration provided for the restrictive covenant. Here's the best thing about the common law. Is payment necessary during the period of the restrictive covenant? And if not, does it help? Generally speaking, payment is not necessary during the period of restrictive covenant, i.e. it's free and it doesn't really cost you much if you get it wrong. It just, you get it wrong. Does it help if you pay the employee? Well, maybe. but I wouldn't do it as a way to think, okay, well, I'm going to be able to justify my non-compete. No. In a line ball case, then maybe the fact that you agree to pay compensation might be enough to get you over. But the mere fact that you agree to pay compensation is not going to mean that you get to enforce the non-compete. Now, same token, I don't think the employee gets to keep the money, but you know, don't look at that and think, okay, I can just pay for it. It's not going to help. What relief is available? Obviously, injunctive relief is the primary relief that we're looking for in common law countries. It's quite easy to get. If we can demonstrate that we've got a serious case to be tried, there's all the usual caveats, blah, 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 but that's what you're typically looking for in a non-compete, particularly because damages are often very difficult to prove and penalty clauses or liquidated damages clauses are generally not particularly enforceable in common law countries. Liquidated damages, because they're usually it's so hard to show that they're a genuine pre-estimate of damages in these kind of cases, they're usually going to get struck down as a penalty clause. Another issue, I know there's a question that's been asked about it, and it comes back to the tightly drafted and sort of being hearing about it tangentially as we go through these slides, but you know, will a court blue pencil a non-compete, non-solicit, will they rewrite it? Generally, in a common law country, I would say the answer is no. Now, you'll probably be able to sever unenforceable aspects of your non-compete clause. So if you draft it well, you can have severable aspects to it, then that might save you. But in terms of rewriting a clause, then I would say, generally speaking, they're not going to do that. So that's the summary. You know, they're prima facie void, but they can be enforceable, and they don't cost you anything to enforce. They must be reasonable, and you assess reasonableness at the beginning, and you need to have it tightly drafted, and it needs to be relevant to the employee. I wanted to mention two common law exceptions. Malaysia, it's not that necessarily that big a deal. There is a lot of manufacturing that goes on in Malaysia, so it can be relevant there. India, obviously India, we're looking now, it's got 1/7 of the world's population. These locations have statutory rules which basically are interpreted as prohibiting post-termination non-competes. It's a little unclear the extent to which you might be able to enforce a non-solicit. Unfortunately, the courts in both of these countries are pretty heavily clogged, particularly in India, so by the time you actually get in front of a judge, it may not matter anyway. But it's I wouldn't say it's a real problem, but it's one of the difficulties with having employees in India. Very difficult to protect your confidential information, high employee turnover, and a non-compete is unenforceable. So it's one of the challenges that you face in India, and it's a challenge that's coming up more and more because, you know, quite frankly, more and more of our employees are located in India. All right, that completes the common law aspect. To the extent I can, I wanted to talk about the rest of the world, all, I don't know, 150 other countries, however many it is. As I said, I'm not going to say that these are the rules that apply throughout the rest of the world. There are themes that do keep popping up, but the only way that you can really look at the rest of the world is country by country. So while you can actually say, okay, for the UK, Australia, Singapore, Hong Kong, yeah, maybe I can just use the one clause in Canada, you know, and get by with most of it, you're going to have very different clauses country by country if you want to have an enforceable non-compete and or non-solicit in the rest of the world. So again, when you're looking at doing these type of projects, do be prepared for a little bit of pain, and don't do it just because it's nice to have. Do it because you actually need to do it, because you don't get to, you know, take shortcuts necessarily with the approach. And one of the reasons for that is that you often find that you've got long civil codes or long labour codes in a lot of these countries, which quite prescriptively set out the requirements for the clause, the requirements for a valid non-compete. You need to follow those. Again, they vary country by country in the same way that languages vary country by country. You do find this repeating idea of reasonableness. And it's very interesting to me when I think about all the ways that these different legal systems developed. They all seem to get this idea, well, there needs to be a reasonableness to the non-compete. You can't just stop someone from going off and working full stop. It manifests itself in different ways in countries around the world. And in some places it can say, okay, well, the reasonableness, the way that shines through is that you need to make sure that the clause Its scope, its geographical effect, and the time period for which it operates, you need to make sure that all of those are reasonable. Very similar to the common law countries, and France is an example of that, I think. Another way is it must require proportionality between the clause and the interest sought to protect it. This idea of a legitimate business interest, you do see that in plenty of the European countries, for example, this idea of proportionality, and even in a lot of the Asian countries, I would say as well. Are you going too far? Are you stopping the employee from doing something which is out of proportion with what you really have an interest in doing? I wouldn't say that, as much as I can predict a trend, that you have the same detailed examination of the relationship between each particular proscribed activity and the legitimate interest that you're trying to protect. It's a much more global analysis that will happen, but there is still going to be an analysis happening and saying, okay, well, should we actually, do you actually have any kind of justification, that's a good word to use, for having this non-compete? So again, that goes to the point. If your goal in any particular country is simply to stop an employee competing with you, you're going to find that difficult to enforce. A very interesting thing outside of the common law countries is the approach that is taken towards non-solicitation clauses. You can find that you will have locations which don't really know how to deal with a non-solicit clause. They may not have any precise law about it. It may be uncommon in that jurisdiction. And it's uncertain exactly how the court is going to approach it in any particular case. That can be tricky. You've got situations where a court is going to consider it to be a form of a non-competition obligation. Rather than just sort of this broader idea of a restrictive covenant, they're going to say, well, no, it's a non-competition obligation. And that means that you're going to be subject to all the rules on non-competition. And as you'll see, one of those rules is often paying compensation. So for an agreement with an employee that they can't solicit another employee, which is often that not that valuable to you, you might find yourself in a situation where you end up having to pay the employee for that obligation. The other point I would say is that sometimes they're just void. They just say, okay, well, yes, this is a non-compete obligation. We have a situation where only these particular types of non-compete obligations are allowed. It addresses competition between the former employer and the new employer. It doesn't talk about solicitation or so on. Therefore, you can't do it because the law doesn't allow you to do it. Those tend to be the three type of situations again. And I would definitely say that when you move away from the common law countries, when you start looking at European countries, when you start looking at South American countries, African countries, the non-solicit clause generally tends to become less useful to you. Again, for one of the reasons here, which I mentioned, you don't have discovery. So how do you actually prove that there's been a breach? You're required to basically present your evidence to the court. It's a civil law system. It's an inquisitorial system. If you don't have proof of the breach, if you can't produce written evidence that there's breach occurred, and often it doesn't occur with writing, it's somebody calling somebody up, how do you prove that? It is very difficult to do that. And for that reason alone, that can just sort of be a reason why you don't see non-solicitation clauses used as frequently outside of the common law countries. One of the things that is interesting, though, is that you'll often see that much longer time periods are permitted. If you look at China, you can have a non-compete for up to 2 years there. If you look at Germany, you can have a non-compete for up to 2 years there. If you look at Italy, depending on the level of employee, you could have a non-compete for up to 5 years. There is an acceptance, it seems, and it's not general. There's certainly places where the maximum period of a non-compete, for example, is 6 months. But there is an acceptance that you can prevent people working against you or for a competitor for a much longer time than a common law country would ever accept. Now, one of the reasons we'll see for this is the next point is because compensation is often required to be paid during that period. It's part of the inherent quid pro quo. You remember, for a common law country, there's no requirement to pay a person during a non-compete period. If a non-compete is reasonable, then it's reasonable on its own feet. It does not require payment. Many, many countries, particularly in Europe, you're talking about France, you're talking about Italy, you're talking about Germany, Scandinavian countries, all the big locations in Europe tend to require payment during the non-compete period. So it's going to cost you money. So it's another reason why when you're going internationally, don't just have a agreement which says, okay, well, you can't compete against us for this period of time. Because you may be committing yourself to paying for that period of time. Even though you haven't provided for it in your clause, well, you know, part of the quid pro quo is that, okay, well, if you're going to stop me competing, then the courts say, well, I'll fix up the invalidity. And part of the invalidity is you haven't agreed to pay the person. So now you have to start paying the person. That payment can often be in a lump sum up front, in which case, well, do you get value for the money? If the employee then goes and joins a non-competitor and starts earning compensation from them. Now, there can be clawback provisions, but you know, you're going to sue to get that back and so on. It is much more complicated once you have to start paying for these obligations because you're going to be in situations where it's difficult for people to keep track of who's got what obligation, and it's difficult to keep track of it from payroll purposes. And you know, you might actually have a situation where you want to enforce it, you haven't kept complete track of am I required to pay for it, you don't pay for it and the whole clause falls over. So again, it's another reason why you need to be a bit more selective with using non-competes and non-solicits once you get outside of the common law countries. I do want to mention as well, there are plenty of locations, Korea, Japan are two locations where you don't have to pay compensation, but it's certainly going to be something that's being taken into account in looking in deciding whether or not the clause is reasonable. So again, contrasting the common law case, the payment of compensation generally doesn't get factored into whether or not the clause is reasonable. There's plenty of locations around the world where it is a factor, and so it may not be required to pay compensation. And so you hear that and you say, okay, well, I'm not going to pay compensation. Great. But in the absence of that, you might have doomed yourself anyway because it is a factor that the court will take into account. So again, always think about, well, even if it's not required, am I really going to be able to enforce this? This is always an interesting point. You might not be able to waive your non-compete clause in the circumstances where you have to pay for it. When you look at Germany, this is perhaps the biggest disincentive in Germany to using a non-compete clause. If you're going to waive a non-compete clause, which, as you know, carries the obligation to pay compensation, you need to give 12-month notice of that waiver. So who knows whether or not an employee is going to be resigning in 12 months? You don't. So you are, in Germany, for example, committing. When you sign that non-compete agreement, you are committing to paying this person after their employment terminates. And keep in mind as well that it's often in circumstances when you're already paying them to get them out of the company. So it's something that can just add to your cost. China is another location. It's not actually captured in the laws, but there is judicial interpretation that was put out. And it said, okay, well, you need to give 3 months' notice of it. So even in China, the employee leaves, you don't really care. You're still going to be paying on the, you're still going to be on the hook for 3 months' compensation when the employee leaves, and all they have to do is make sure that they don't go and join a competitor. Damages for a void clause. Now, interestingly, in France, and some of you might know this, but in France, if your clause is void, then the employee actually has a right to sue you for damages. So it's not, again, in the case in the common law countries where it just falls over. The clause is void, so the employee can sue for damages. Now, there's been some developments last year about that, about the extent to which damages can be claimed, do they need to be proved, and so on. But it's still, again, when you're looking at France, it's a reason why that you need to be careful in France, particularly because the French courts really, really do look at the geography and really do look at the time period for which the non-compete's in effect. So again, you know, be careful when you're looking at some of these expensive European countries where it's already expensive enough to terminate employment if you're going to be committing to non-competes. Limited to certain types of employees, can be based on the amount of wages earned. You know, in particular, I'm thinking Belgium here, there's a class of non-competes that's permitted if a person earns over a certain amount of money each year. If they're under that, well, you can't have that non-compete. It can be based on the category of employee. Is the employee a managerial employee? Is an employee in a position of trust? are those the type of employee, those type of employees you're allowed to have a non-compete for? It can be decided by reference to the type of work performed by the employee. If I'm thinking here of China, it says that it's for senior managers, it's for R&D, and it's for salespeople that you can have a non-compete. The implication being for everybody else, well, you can't have a non-compete. Again, pick and choose who you apply these non-competes and non-solicits to. This is, I think, perhaps the biggest difference and perhaps the biggest advantage that the non-common law countries will have over the common law countries. In that civil law countries tend to be a lot more forgiving of liquidated damages clauses and don't have the same principle around a penalty. And so you'll often have, in these civil law countries and a lot of European countries, that for each breach you need to pay, let's call it €25,000, and then for each day that the breach continues, you need to pay another €1,000 per day. And that will often be enforced. And it's not just Europe. Again, I'm talking about China. It's something that you can use in China. And it's, often, and it's probably the most effective way to enforce it in China because injunctive relief can be rare. I think you should consider this. When we're sitting here in the States and we have that sort of bad reaction to the idea, okay, it's a penalty clause. I can't do that, or no one's going to want to sign it if I'm putting in that they have to pay me tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of dollars if they breach this clause. They are quite common. And it's, again, it's one of those situations where we need to check our own prejudices about what is legally and what is acceptable and what is legally unacceptable. We need to check that when we go to a lot of these different countries, and we need to say, okay, well, am I just thinking about it from my own perspective? If I was asked to sign a contract that says I have to pay $50,000 for breach, I'd never sign that. But if it's in a circumstance where it's quite common in that location, then yes, you should be using those clauses, at least in my view, because it gives you the best way of actually providing an incentive for the employee not to breach. Because, as I said, discovery can be difficult. Injunctive relief can sometimes be difficult to enforce. Court systems work differently. Actual damages are going to always be very difficult to prove, but a lump sum of money that the employee has to pay, yeah, I mean, that's a fairly powerful motivator. The other point that you will see is that effectiveness might depend on the reason for termination. Now, usually speaking, again, compare contrast, common law countries, the reason for the employee leaving the employment should not matter. Now, I will say that there has been departures from that in particular countries. So there's a line of authority in the UK that if you breach the contract, then you actually can't enforce the post-termination non-compete, which can be an issue if you have an actual notice clause in the UK and you terminate by just terminating immediately and prepaying the damages. But there's plenty of countries, again, in Europe where you've got a, if you terminate the employee for business reasons, or if the employee leaves because of a breach of contract by you, then you can't enforce the non-compete against them. So you're looking at situations where the employee is terminated for cause, or the employee resigns, or the employee is terminated for poor performance, if permitted by that country. You can't just assume that because the employee is leaving, because they've been impacted by a restructure, that, okay, well, I'll be able to enforce this clause now. Again, it is yet another rule that can come up, which is surprising to us because, you know, it restricts the non-compete in a way that we're not familiar with. Last couple of points, probably for the non-common law world. With the drafting, as long as you meet the statutory rules, you'll often, as I picked up this point earlier, you'll often find that a lot more leeway is given to the drafting. You'll be able to get away with just saying, okay, well, you can't compete with the employer after termination of employment, provided that employer pays money, blah, 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 okay? You don't have to worry about a lot of those qualifications on linking it to the legitimate interest, the actual knowledge of the employee, and so on. The court, when they look at, if the clause gets challenged, the court will look at that in a kind of global way and take that into account when assessing the reasonableness of the action. And again, there are places, and I think there's been a question about this, there are countries outside of the common law world, and I mentioned India and Malaysia as two places where non-competes are banned altogether. There are places where non-common law countries do ban non-competes. And I think the most obvious example is that is neighbors to the south in Mexico. You cannot have a valid non-compete in Mexico, for example. Russia. Russia is very much in the news today. Russia is another place where, generally speaking, the non-compete during employment is not going to be enforceable. That, I think, probably winds up sort of my ideas about trends, themes that you find in non-competes, non-solicits. I just wanted to spend the last 5 minutes just giving you an idea about the mobile employee and some of the issues that I'm beginning to see more and more often as our employees tend to travel the globe more. So you've got your situation of the multi-jurisdictional employee, the employee who's transferred from location to location. Now, there's usual two ways that this can happen. They can transfer from one employer to another employer to another employer, or they can remain employed by the same employer and then go on assignment to work for one particular, you know, the location in China or in a location in Brazil, location in Sweden, and so on. But they're all the time remaining employed by their employer in Australia. In that circumstance, then you've got a situation where you've probably got an Australian non-compete. But what about if they've been working in Germany for the last 5 years and your non-compete agreement with them in Australia has got absolutely nothing to do with the very long and prescriptive rules that are required by a German non-compete? What country's contract applies? How can you manage this? Well, one way to manage it might be to actually have two or more, depending on where the person goes, non-compete agreements. If you're worried that the person could harm you either in their home country or their host country, maybe as part of the international assignment, when they go over to the host country, they sign a new non-compete agreement with the host country employer. Now, that can get a bit complicated as well, because sometimes you want to try and keep away from the idea that the host country is actually employing the person. So there are some, you know, things to consider there, but it's one possible solution. Otherwise, what are you going to be stuck with? Well, let's say that you've signed an agreement in Denmark, and then you want to go and take it and enforce it in Mexico, or you want to go and enforce it in Japan, and you've got judgment in Denmark. What do you actually go and do? How do you get the foreign court to recognize your agreement, your judgment? It is a very difficult thing to do, and it is one of the hardest things to do, and one of the most sort of, I guess, unsolved issues in non-competes is how do you actually go and stop someone who has a contract governed by the laws of one country and was worked for you in one country when they go to another country and work in breach of their non-compete? Because if they've got no assets in your own country, what can you realistically do to stop them? You need to get to the host country, the country they're working now. But what are the issues that you find there? Well, okay, well, say you get a judgment. Say you get an interlocutory judgment in your host country, in your original country, and you take it to the country where the person's working now. Is that going to be enforceable? Oftentimes not. The rules for enforcing foreign judgments differ very wildly from country to country. You know, in China, I doubt you're ever going to be able to enforce a U.S. law in U.S. court's judgment. But one of the things that a court will often look to is, well, is this a final judgment? Has it disposed of all matters between the parties? And if it's an interlocutory judgment, then the answer is no. So you'll find a situation where the foreign court will say, well, this is an interlocutory judgment. It hasn't been finally decided. I'm not enforcing this. Or you might have actually got injunctive relief. And let's assume you've got it as a final form of relief. You've got final injunctive relief. That can be difficult to enforce because when you're looking at foreign judgments, again, each country's got its own rules, but one of the things that a foreign court will often look at is, well, is this judgment enforceable in personam? Like, is it a debt that is enforceable directly against the person? If it's a form of injunctive relief, then that is going to be a lot more difficult to enforce. There's a public policy aspect to all situations when you're looking to enforce a foreign judgment or when you're looking to enforce a foreign agreement. So say, for example, you've got your foreign law agreement. Rather than getting a judgment in your own country, you go to the other country and you try and get a judgment there. Most times, the foreign court, if it accepts jurisdiction, is going to look at the public policy of, well, is this the kind of thing which I want to enforce? So
whether it be a judgment or whether it be an agreement, they're going to say, okay, well, you know, that's awesome that you've spent all this time proving to me that your clause was valid under the ideas, you know, under the guise of US law. But unfortunately, here in Taiwan, this is what we require. Bang, 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 bang. Your clause does none of that. Your clause prevents the employee from working for this company, and the employee is not compensated at all for that. That's contrary to our rules in this country. That's contrary to our public policy, so we are not going to enforce this clause. So you've just gone and spent either a huge amount trying to enforce a foreign judgment, or you spent a huge amount getting foreign experts in front of a Taiwanese court to prove what US law says, and it's all for naught, because in the end, they're still going to look at their own rules and say, well, should we as a matter of public policy enforce this in our own country? And if you're inconsistent with that country's rules on non-competes, non-solicits, then I would posit a guess that most courts are going to say to you, look, you know, we're not going to let you enforce that here. That brings me to the top of the hour, and it also brings me, I hope, to the end. You can find more information about not only international employment law issues, but also trade secrets generally at our blog, Trading Secrets, Trade Secrets Law. In finishing, I'd like to thank you for today. I'm afraid I've run out of time for questions, but certainly if you do have questions, feel free to get in contact with me either by phone, drop me an email, and of course, happy to, you know, provide whatever guidance I can. I want to thank everyone for their attendance today, and I hope this has been of help and educational for you.
This concludes today's webinar. Thank you for attending.